Good morning. Good morning. I'm Richard. I'm co-director of Alternatives. I'd like to warmly welcome you to this seminar with Graham Hancock and to Logan Hall. This is a beautiful venue. You know it very well. We've hosted many, many speakers here over the years. We've only once before sold out Logan Hall, and that was in 2019 when we last hosted Graham Hancock here. So it is sold out today, so thank you for your great enthusiasm in being here. So it's always a huge pleasure to be hosting Graham Hancock. We've been hosting him for 20 years at Alternatives. I'm sure he has many, many books I'm sure you've read, and now Ancient Apocalypse has brought him a whole new audience. Please join me in giving a very warm welcome to Graham Hancock.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you for such a warm welcome. I hugely appreciate this. And I want to say this at the beginning. My mic's not working. That's what I want to say at the beginning. Let's get that sorted out before we do anything else. So what I wanted to say at the beginning is, obviously, this is a controversial idea that I've been working around for the last 30 years. And obviously, I've come in for a lot of attacks. And sometimes those attacks are very hurtful and very painful for me. But what I take strength from is the support and love and encouragement that you guys give me. That's what keeps me going. Thank you. So I want to thank you for that from the bottom of my heart. Now, I'm not going to just sort of recover the ground that was covered in Ancient Apocalypse. I'm going to talk more widely around the subject. And I want to begin by thanking my wonderful photographer wife, Santha Faya. Santha and I have made every journey together for the last 30 years. And speaking completely frankly, I would be nowhere in this world if it wasn't for this wonderful woman by my side. Santha is a brilliant photographer, and she took the vast majority of the photographs that I'm going to show here. Where it's not the case, we've credited the other photographer who was involved, but where there's no credit, it's Santha's picture. So, here were some sensational headlines from 2015. Were Aborigines the first Americans? Native tribes in the Amazon found to be more closely related to indigenous Australians. And it speaks of a genetic study that reveals Amazonian tribes, three of them share more DNA with Australian Aborigines than any other present-day population. And the study suggests that Aboriginal ancestors may have colonized South America. It challenges theories of how Native Americans first arrived in the Americas. Well, of course, this is the Daily Mail, so, you know, we can expect sensational headlines. However, in this case, they're spot on, and the sensational headlines reveal even more sensational scientific research behind it. And this is the this is a little extract from the scientific research. There's been this long-held view that there was a single origin for all Native American peoples, and that nevertheless that view has been challenged by some, but advances in DNA technology are making these kind of explorations much more possible. And what's been discovered is this very puzzling connection between the peoples of Australasia, particularly Papua New Guinea, and certain tribes deep in the Amazon rainforest. Now, this is a real mystery, because the view... I'll come to that. What makes it even more of a mystery is further research in 2018 on members of these tribes and looking for ancient skeletal remains. They found ancient skeletal remains 10,400 years old in the Amazon, which bear that same signal. And this tells us that this Aboriginal connection reached South America very, very long ago, and researchers are agreed that it must have reached South America in the late Pleistocene, which is near the end of the last ice age. It's a very important study because it establishes that there's no recent connection here. This is a very ancient connection in South America. And it really creates a problem because the view of archaeology for decades, really a century, has been that all the peopling of the Americas happened this way, that they crossed the Bering Straits, which were a land bridge during the Ice Age. Sea level was lower then, and that they traveled through North America and eventually down into South America. The problem is that this genetic signal isn't found anywhere in North America. It's only found in South America and in Papua New Guinea and neighboring areas. I talked to Eske Willislev, who's one of the world's leading geneticists, whose recent work focuses on the peopling of the Americas. And I'll just read a bit of this email exchange. Willislev told me that currently no one has a good explanation of the Australo-Melanesian signal. All that's put forward as possible explanations are purely speculative. What we do know is that it's present in some Native American groups, particularly from Brazil. We also know it has to be pre-Columbian. Amongst the possible explanations for the presence of this Australo-Melanesian DNA in the Amazon, Professor Willislev offered in his email exchange with me the following. Someone holding this signal comes into the Americas not through Beringia, but crossing into South America across the ocean. Based purely on the genetic data, this is the most parsimonious explanation, but it does not make practical sense. So I asked Eske why it doesn't make practical sense. Is he basing that on the archaeological consensus that our Upper Paleolithic and Early Holocene ancestors were incapable of undertaking long transoceanic voyages? And his reply, in regard to crossing the Pacific, I'm not saying it did not happen, but there is no evidence suggesting that humans were capable of such a journey until quite late in history, the Polynesian expansion. It's a possibility, and I'm open to the idea, but there's not much evidence supporting it except going for the most parsimonious solution of the genetic data. Well, let me say right at the outset that in science, parsimony is looked for. It's best to look for the easiest and most direct and most simple explanation of something rather than elaborating huge other explanations. And this mysterious genetic signal in South America is best explained because none of it's in North America, by a crossing of the Pacific during the Ice Age, which supposedly our ancestors were incapable of doing. So we're in the habit of dividing the world into the New World and the Old World. And it's generally held, it's generally been the view that all civilization began in the Old World. And this book, History Begins at Sumer, by Professor Samuel Noah Kramer, is a hugely influential text. And basically what he's saying is that Sumer, ancient Sumer in Mesopotamia, was the first human civilization, the first organization of human beings that deserved to be called a civilization. And it's still influential, even though it was first published in 1956. And indeed, this part of the Old World is a center of civilization. There's no doubt about it. I mean, there's the Sumerian Empire. And up there, we have the incredible site of Göbekli Tepe between the headwaters of the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. They call this area Mesopotamia because it means between the rivers. Can't help feeling that there's some connection between what happened in Sumer and what happened much earlier in Göbekli Tepe. But the new evidence from the Americas threatens to overturn this paradigm that places the origins of civilization in the Middle East. The world was so different during the last ice age. There were ice caps 3 kilometers deep. Sea level was 400 feet lower than it is today. And there were freezing temperatures. But then, really rather abruptly, around 11,600 years ago, the ice age came to an end. And the whole face of the world changed. everything became different, and we start to look at the world as we see it today. So there is the conventional notion. There's the Bering Straits now, and there's how they were during the Ice Age. And it did seem obvious to archaeologists that this must have been the main route for getting into the Americas. And indeed, for a long time, they held it was the only route for getting into the Americas. And there was a theory that there had been an ice-free corridor between the Cordillera and the Laurentide ice sheets. That theory, by the way, has been recently completely blown out of the water. Nobody could have used that ice-free corridor because it didn't exist. Here's the general picture of these migrations and through that supposed ice-free corridor and down into North America about 12,000 years ago, and then eventually onwards into South America. It's these genetic discoveries of this close relationship between Australasians and certain peoples in the Amazon rainforest that are challenging the long-held view of the peopling of the Americas. The long-held view became a dogma, and that dogma was called Clovis First. These were supposed to be the Clovis culture, were supposed to be the first inhabitants of North America. And they're not supposed to have come into North America until around 13,400 years ago. And mysteriously, 12,800 years ago, they vanish entirely from the stage. They're recognized by these fantastic fluted points that they made. So they were held to be the first culture of the Americas. And for decades, archaeologists were adamant that no human beings had entered the Americas before 13,400 years ago. But things are beginning to change. This is a report from 2013. Not so long ago, there was a seemingly incontrovertible answer to the question of how and when the first settlers made it to the Americas. Some 13,000 years ago, a group of people from Asia walked across a land bridge that connected Siberia to Alaska and headed south. And these people were known to us as the Clovis. By the way, why do we call them the Clovis culture? They didn't call themselves that. We have no idea what they called themselves that. I'll tell you why. Because there's a site called Blackwater Draw down in New Mexico. And in that site were found many of those Clovis points by archaeologists. But the problem was there was no beer available right there at the site. But where there was beer available was in the town of Clovis, New Mexico, about 10 miles away. So they called it the Clovis culture. Yeah. For decades, this was the received wisdom. So compelling was the Clovis First model that few archaeologists even contemplated an alternative. Some with the temerity to do so complained of a Clovis police intent on suppressing dissent. And believe me, the Clovis police was a real, real thing. It wrecked the lives of quite a number of archaeologists who took a dissenting view and held that it was absurd to suggest that the Americas had only been populated 13,000 years ago. Of course, they'd been populated earlier. And Jacques Cinq-Mars, who conducted excavations at Bluefish Caves in the Yukon, found evidence of the presence of humans in the Americas more than 20,000 years ago. That was heresy to the Clovis police. They descended upon him. They recruited their friends in the media to attack him, to present him as a pseudoscientist, to say that he was telling lies, to say that he was fraudulently presenting evidence. They did everything possible to ruin his career. And as the Smithsonian later admitted, rather than launching a major new search for more early evidence, the finds stirred fierce opposition and a bitter debate, one of the most acrimonious and unfruitful in all of science, as Nature later put it. And poor Jacques Cinq-Mars, he was ruined by the Clovis police. His research funding was withdrawn. He was passed by in corridors with my colleagues who would no longer speak to him. He was treated as a pariah. He, in every way, was insulted and humiliated. But he was right. Because Bluefish Caves were re-excavated. And we now know that people were butchering horses and other animals in Bluefish Caves 24,000 years ago. Jacques Cinq-Mars was totally correct, and this more recent research completely vindicates him, but too late to save him from the destruction of his career that fellow archaeologists inflicted upon him. As the Smithsonian admitted in 2017, the study does raise serious questions about the effect of the bitter decades-long debate over the peopling of the New World. Did archaeologists in the mainstream marginalize dissenting voices on this key issue? And if so, what was the impact on North American archaeology? Did the intense criticism of pre-Clovis sites produce a chilling effect, stifling new ideas and hobbling the search for early sites? The scientific atmosphere, recalls Tom Dillehay, was clearly toxic and clearly impeded science. So that's March the 8th, 2017. Now, these days, if you talk to archaeologists about Clovis not being first anymore, they'll say, oh, we knew that all along. We've been saying that since the 1990s. Rubbish. Rubbish. A few archaeologists have been saying it, but the majority were ganging up on them with the forces of the Clovis police. So we're told here in 2007 that Clovis was debunked by National Geographic. The Clovis people, known for their distinctive pierheads, were not the first humans to set foot in the Americas after all. That's 2007. 2012, once again, Clovis is debunked. The Clovis theory is put to rest at Paisley Caves. And then Wikipedia, admitting now recently, by the way, I regard Wikipedia as a profound source of disinformation. And I know from looking at Wikipedia entries from a subject that I know about that they're not telling the whole truth. They're presenting an agenda. And I suggest that's probably true for everything that's on Wikipedia. It's the first stop that we all go to get information, but it's not a reliable source. It's a source of disinformation. It's useful, but check everything they say very, very, very carefully. So Clovis, the need to debunk Clovis keeps on happening again and again. It comes back like a sort of zombie, and it has to be killed again. It just won't go away. So here's a 2022 report in the big thing, Clovis debunked. Hey, archaeologists now saying they debunked it in the 90s and in the 2000s, and now in 2022 they're still needing to say it's been debunked. This is an ongoing debate, and we have not got rid of that zombie yet. There are still people clinging to the Clovis first idea. But here's Al Goodyear. Al Goodyear has excavated a site called Topper, which puts man in North America 50,000 years ago. He was subjected to the same kind of attacks that Jack St. Mars was subjected to. There I am talking with Al Goodyear, and he took me to the site, and he explained that initially they went there to investigate what they thought was entirely a Clovis site. But then they did something that other archaeologists had never done, because archaeologists were told there's no point in looking deeper than Clovis. You know, with these layers in the soil, the younger material is at the top and the older material is at the bottom. They said there's no point in looking deeper because we know that Clovis was first. But Al Goodyear dissented, and he dug deeper. And digging deeper below the Clovis lair, he found compelling evidence that humans had been present more than 50,000 years ago. It's now beginning to be reluctantly accepted by the archaeological community, but Al went through decades of hate and unpleasantness because he stood out from the crowd. The Cerruti Mastodon site is another extraordinary site. My God, I mean, those Clovis police are saying humans were only in America for 13,000 years ago. Here's a site that shows humans were in America 130,000 years ago, 10 times as long. This is the work of paleontologist Tom Demaray and a number of his colleagues at the San Diego Natural History Museum. And they found a mastodon, the remains of a mastodon, which had clearly been butchered and the marrow extracted by human beings. Exactly what kind of human beings they were 130,000 years ago, we can't say for sure. Because 130,000 years ago, there were Neanderthals. There were Denisovans. There were also anatomically modern humans. But the handiwork of humans is clearly evident in this site. And Tom Demery took me backstage in the San Diego Natural History Museum, and he showed me that evidence, and it's utterly compelling. But of course, he was immediately attacked. They don't call them the Clovis police anymore, but there was just a general attack on what was regarded as the fantastical notion that human beings could have been in the Americas 130,000 years ago. And Tom Demaray and his team have replied to that attack very thoroughly, refuting it. But the friends of the dead hand of archaeology in the media keep on reporting that it's been debunked. It has not been debunked. Any attempt to debunk it has in fact been debunked by Tom Demaray and his colleagues. Here's Paulette Steeves. She's a Native American archaeologist, and she is very unhappy with the way that American archaeology is evolving. And she talks about how ignorance is produced through neglect, secrecy, suppression, destruction of documents, unquestioned tradition, and socio-political selectivity. Educational materials were framed in such a way to support colonization of the mind, teaching people to think in ways acceptable to the nation state, and not to question so-called scientific authorities. So look, this is why my kids made for me a t-shirt with the words, I'm not wearing it today, but stuff just keeps on getting older. Because you know, if you have a relatively short time frame to deal with, then searching for a lost civilization becomes much more complex and much more difficult. But if you have a very long time frame to deal with, there's much more material to investigate. And if the Americas have been inhabited by humans for 130,000 years, which is more than twice as long as Europe, then our understanding of prehistory must change. We have a vast resource-rich landmass here, and it may have been the location of hitherto unrecognized advances and developments in the story of civilization. But if this were so, why have archaeologists thus far failed to recognize these developments and advances? Well, here's a bit of the open letter that the Society for American Archaeology published and sent to Netflix, complaining about my Ancient Apocalypse series, saying really vile things about it, and demanding that Netflix reclassify it as science fiction, because it doesn't represent the orthodox archaeological point of view. And I'll just read their justification. After more than a century of professional archaeological investigations, we find no archaeological evidence to support the existence of an advanced global ice age civilization of the kind Hancock suggests. Archaeologists have investigated hundreds of ice age sites and published the results in rigorously reviewed journals. The assertion that Ancient Apocalypse is a factual docu-series or documentary rather than entertainment with ideological goals is preposterous. If there were any credible evidence for a global ice age civilization of the kind Hancock suggests, archaeologists would investigate it and report their findings with rigor according to the scientific methods, practices, and theories of our discipline. If the evidence warranted scientific peer review, we would acquire funding to test it, publish our results, and promote it in our own outreach materials. Contrary to Hancock's claims, archaeology does not willfully ignore credible evidence, nor does it seek to suppress it in a conspiratorial fashion. I actually don't think that any conspiracy is going on here. I think people get locked into a particular mindset. Their careers depend on it. The approval of their colleagues depend on it. The funding for their research depends on it. They get invested in that mindset, and they find it very difficult to see outside it. Part of the problem is that very ancient structures, thousands of years older than archaeologists suppose, may be hiding in plain view, surrounded by other younger structures. And the best example of that really is the Great Sphinx of Giza. And these two temples in front of it. This temple is a New Kingdom temple, much later even than the accepted date of the Sphinx, but which is about 4,500 years ago. But the Sphinx and these two temples are deeply anomalous. And the erosion patterns in the trench around the Sphinx, and which were originally on the body of the Sphinx before it was restored, speak eloquently of what is called precipitation-induced weathering. And this was first noticed by the late, great John Anthony West, a dear friend of mine, who passed away in 2018. And John West brought Professor Robert Schock, a geologist from Boston University, to the site. And Schock said, it's obvious. This site has been subjected to at least 1,000 years of heavy rainfall. When did that happen? Well, it happened between roughly 12,800 and 11,600 years ago. That's the last time that there were rains capable of causing this level of erosion in the Egyptian desert. See those deep vertical fissures running down there? That's the rainwater pouring off the side of the escarpment and selectively hollowing out the weaker areas of rock. For most of the 20th century, was the consensus of archaeologists that megalithic architecture was beyond the capacities of hunter-gatherers and required the presence of long-term settled agricultural communities to evolve. And it seemed to reinforce this view that no megalithic architecture had been found anywhere in the world that was more than 6,000 years old. In fact, that was one of the main arguments that the archaeological police used to try to dismiss John West and Robert Schock. They said, show us another culture that's 12,000 years old anywhere in the world, and we might listen to you. But we know that there is no culture capable of creating anything like the Sphinx until 4,500 years ago. Therefore, of course, the Sphinx is 4,500 years ago. But of course, that changed completely with Göbekli Tepe, which is a deliberately buried site, deliberately buried 11,600 years ago, a very, very ancient site. Sorry, it began 11,600 years ago. It was deliberately buried about 1,000 years later, and thus sealed, and thus an intact archaeological scene. And the evidence from Göbekli Tepe is that this site is 11,600 years old. It dates to the end of a period called the Younger Dryas, which I'll talk a bit more about. And my goodness, if you're capable of creating these 20-ton megalithic pillars and this huge site, then you're certainly capable of creating the Great Sphinx. So the notion that the Sphinx is somehow out of context has to completely change now that we have Göbekli Tepe. I'm here with the late Professor Klaus Schmidt, who, unlike most archaeologists, did not sort of make the sign of the cross and run away as soon as I appeared on the site, but actually gave me 3 days of his time and talked me through the site in great depth. Tragically, he passed away in 2014, and he's been succeeded by a very closed-minded group of archaeologists. What he's telling me, why he's pointing at the ground, is that there's hundreds of pillars as yet unexcavated, still deeply buried under the ground, huge enclosures under the ground that they haven't excavated yet. The story of Göbekli Tepe is just beginning. And neighboring Karahan Tepe, back in 2014, when Santa and I first went there, all you could see at Karahan Tepe was a few interesting-looking bits of stone sticking out of the ground. But now Karahan Tepe has been excavated, and this is how it looks today. An extraordinary megalithic site of the same age as Göbekli Tepe, around about 11,600 years ago. Here we have pillars carved directly out of the bedrock, and then one freestanding pillar included there, and then this curious face sticking out of the wall, which I must say gave me the chills the first time I saw it. I don't know what it's about. It's got a sort of snake-like feeling and with a human head on the end of a snake's body. So there is reason to conclude that the Sphinx does not stand alone, that there are now recognized archaeological sites which involved huge amounts of workmanship that are as old as the Sphinx. And I wonder if some other sites have been misinterpreted, if sites are multi-layered, that many different cultures have been involved in them, and archaeologists perhaps making the mistake of just dating them to the most recent culture that was present. This is Baalbek in the Lebanon, undoubtedly a Roman temple here. Temple of Jupiter that I'm sitting in, and behind it the Temple of Bacchus, dedicated to wine. Those Romans knew how to have fun. A Roman site for sure, but what about this bizarre enclosure wall that surrounds it, which is totally separate from the Temple of Jupiter? What's this about? This is called the Trilithon. Each of these three blocks weighs 900 tons. And it's extraordinary the way they're built into a wall and raised 30 feet above the ground like this, a wall the provenance for which has not been established by archaeology. Just another look, and I'm in the picture for scale at the Trilithon. So nearby is the quarry. And the quarry contains a number of very large blocks that were never transported from the quarry site. Now, the one I'm standing on weighs 1,000 tons, 100 tons more than the ones in that wall. And that one over there, on the other side of the road, unfortunately used now as a rubbish tip, weighs 1,200 tons. And the one here, that I'm standing on here, which is only recently excavated, turns out to weigh 1,400 tons. Why only recently excavated? Because the whole site was covered in sedimentation. What archaeologists say, and it still amuses me, of course the Romans did everything. They found they could move 900-ton blocks, but 1,000 tons was too much for them. So they couldn't move them. So they just left them in the quarry. In my view, that's a very un-Roman thing to do. The Romans were very practical people. Okay, let's say they couldn't move 1,000 tons, but having gone to all the work of creating huge megaliths like this, they wouldn't have wasted them. They'd have sliced them up like loaves of bread and used the already shaped blocks in other constructions. The fact that they didn't do that, that these are still there, suggests to me the whole site was covered during Roman times, and it's only in more recent times that it's been excavated and revealed. And then let's go to Sacsayhuaman in the Sacred Valley near the town of Cuzco in Peru, in the high Andes. Incredible megaliths there, which archaeology gives entirely to the Incas, even though the Incas themselves recognized and honored the work of predecessors. Archaeology gives this work entirely to the Incas. I mean, that's me, for scale, standing beside that block. And look at these weird sort of holes in the block and the way the blocks are almost fitted, melted together in a very strange manner. It's very different from what is definitely Inca architecture. I'll just show a few more shots. These sort of scallops in the side of the block, these holes, it almost looks like the stone was soft and that people were pressing something into it. Maybe it raises the question, was there a way of manipulating and even melting stone, putting it in place? The work is very fine. I mean, you can't get a razor blade between the joints in the blocks. It's just incredibly fine megalithic work. And I was privileged to spend, I've had several visits to the Andes with Jesus Gamarra, who himself is a descendant of the Incas and who is a local researcher following in the footsteps of his father, who also was intensely interested in the megaliths. And he and his father are both confident, absolutely confident, that the Incas simply were latecomers and that they rebuilt, they built on top of, they modified, they honored by overbuilding the much older structures that are the megalithic structures. And here we are at Pisac, and Jesus is showing me different aspects of the site, and at Sacsayhuaman, and explaining his view that actually there's evidence for three cultures there, the Incas being the last, and that there were two earlier cultures. And he believes that the megalithic work is entirely the work of these earlier cultures and has been wrongly handed to his ancestors, the Incas. And weirdly, up there near Cuzco, we have this curious stonework, and we also have it at Alakahoyuk in Turkey. Exactly the same kind of thing. Is this a coincidence, or is there something going on behind the scenes of history that we've not been fully informed about yet? And oddly, these patterns, these T-shaped pillars that we see at Göbekli Tepe are repeated at the temple of Edfu in Upper Egypt and also in Peru. Let's go to Tiwanaku, even higher in the Andes. We're now 14,000 feet above sea level. And this 300-ton block, God knows how anybody got it up there at 14,000 feet above sea. I can even breathe at 14,000 feet above sea level. It takes me days to get acclimatized. This massive megalithic site in Tiwanaku. And some curiosities. There's these H-shaped blocks. We recognize them as an H because H is a letter in our alphabet. That's, of course, not what they meant to the ancients, but it's the shape I want to draw attention to. Because that same shape appears at Göbekli Tepe. It appears on the belts of some of the figures. Now, I'm not saying that people from Göbekli Tepe brought that idea to the Americas. I suspect it more likely the other way around, actually. What I'm saying is that there appears to be an iconographic connection between the two sites, which is not explained by current theories of archaeology. Tiwanaku is a very controversial site, and archaeologists would like it not to be much more than 2,000 years old. But there's curious astronomical alignments at Tiwanaku, which make it clear that the site was aligned to the summer solstice in 10,500 BC, 12,500 years ago. And this is because the rising point of the sun on the solstice changes as a result of shifts in the obliquity of the Earth's axis over a 41,000-year cycle. Tiwanaku makes much more sense as 12,500 years old from an astronomical point of view than it does as 2,000 years old. Some other figures here. The ones on the right, starting here, are all from Tiwanaku. But over here we have the god Osiris from Egypt, a bearded figure, remembered by the ancient Egyptians as a bringer of the gifts of civilization, not only in Egypt, but in many other lands as well. And down here we have the earliest surviving representation of the feathered serpent, Quetzalcoatl, in Mexico, from the Olmec culture. And again, Quetzalcoatl is remembered in traditions from Central America as a bringer of civilization and as a teacher of civilization. So let's move over now to Tiwanaku. There's this pillar in the so-called semi-subterranean chamber. And on the front of the pillar is this face, which is the face of a deity venerated in the Andes for millennia. And the name of that deity is Viracocha. Notice the heavy beard on the figure here and here. There's a serpent on the side of the pillar. And up here, you can't see it clearly, is a curious animal. We've highlighted it here, this curious creature. And what it looks like is an extinct example of South American megafauna. It looks a lot like Toxodon, which went extinct at the end of the Ice Age. What's it doing on this pillar if the site is only 2,000 years old? Then there's another problem. Okay, I suggest strongly that evidence for much earlier megalithic construction is hiding in plain view and has been misdated by archaeology. But there's a far greater problem that's posed by the huge areas of the Earth where only minimal archaeological investigations have ever been carried out. Well, the Sahara Desert, for example. Yes, there's been some archaeology in the Sahara Desert, but not very much. I get it. It's a very expensive place to work. It's a very tough place to work. And besides, archaeology has the view that there's not much to find there. There has been some archaeology done, but very, very little. Minimal. That's 9.2 million square kilometers of the Earth's surface that hasn't yet really been studied by archaeology at all. It's around about the size of the Republic of China. It's like talking about the world and excluding China completely from the story. We can't say we've got the past completely nailed down when we haven't thoroughly investigated the Sahara Desert. Because the Sahara Desert was green during the Ice Age. It wasn't how it looks today. It was a fertile area for many periods during the Ice Age. And oddly enough, there are ancient maps copied from even older source maps which show river channels in the Sahara and lakes. And weirdly, recent surveys have demonstrated that there was a river channel exactly where indicated on that mysterious ancient map. Here's Antarctica as it looks today. Well, this map was drawn in 1813. It's the Pinkerton World Map. And it's based on the latest science available in 1813. It's a really good map where it comes to South America and South Africa and Australia. But as you will observe, something's missing from the picture. Antarctica isn't there. Why isn't Antarctica there? Because it's an honest map. They hadn't discovered it in 1813. They didn't discover it until 1820. So it's very odd, in my view, that Antarctica appears on much older source maps, which themselves are based on even older source maps. It's interesting, this little legend down here, I've had it translated. Behold clearly to you, O reader, Orontius Phineas Delphinates offers with elegant appearance a geography not so far seen and accurately engraved, which in fact preserves the shape and form of the human heart. And take care that it should be at heart for you. and also presents to your eye provinces, islands, seas, rivers, mountains, not so far seen nor known to some of the great map papers of antiquity, Ptolemy, Eudoxius, Eratosthenes, Macrobius. And we're told that these areas lay in darkness until this map was drawn. I suggest they lay in darkness because they were on the much older source maps that Orontius Phineus and other map makers drew upon, source maps that came out into public circulation from about the 1400s, 1300s onwards, probably taken from Constantinople. And then what about the area of the world that was covered by rising sea levels at the end of the Ice Age? This is another area where very little archaeology has been done. We are talking about 27 million square kilometers. That's roughly equivalent in size to China, the US, and Europe, all added together, that were above water during the Ice Age and that were submerged at the end of the Ice Age. Again, I'll come to those ancient maps. On the left, we have Southeast Asia in 1507 and as it looks today. And on the right, we have an inundation map showing Southeast Asia and Australia as they looked 21,300 years ago when sea level was 400 feet lower than they are today. As you can see, what today is an archipelago of islands and the Malaysian Peninsula was a huge subcontinent-sized landmass. New Guinea was joined to Australia at that time. And it's interesting that this other mysterious map, again drawn from older source maps, seems to depict the Sunda Shelf as it looked during the last Ice Age. So this map is showing present land masses and the sunken land masses that were submerged at the end of the Ice Age. The Sunda Shelf is particularly interesting. We now know that it was highly fertile, highly attractive land during the Ice Age. See, you didn't really want to spend a lot of time in the far northern hemisphere during the Ice Age. You wanted to get down near the equator. That was the best, warmest land on Earth. And this would have been a fantastic place for people to settle and for civilizations to evolve. And that's why I'm so interested, and we depicted it in Ancient Apocalypse, this work by geologist Danny Hillman Natarajan at Gunung Padang on the island of Java. And I'm suggesting, and Danny believes, that this site is originated more than 20,000 years ago. It may have been added to by later cultures. It's still venerated today, but it's a very, very old site in his view. It was one of those high areas that was above water, that remained above water even after sea level rose at the end of the Ice Age. It's on the island of Java, but that island of Java was connected to Sumatra and Borneo and the Malaysian Peninsula when the Sunda Shelf was above water. So, Sahara Desert, 9 million square kilometers, 27 million square kilometers submerged at the end of the Ice Age, the best real estate on Earth. Is marine archaeology being done? Yes, it is. Marine archaeology is being done. It does exist. It's very expensive, and not a lot of it is done. But when I saw this headline, I thought, I've got somebody on my side. Archaeologist explains why we need to look underwater to understand the past. But then the explanation is so disappointing, because what he's looking for is shipwrecks from the 16 and 1700s. And that's primarily what all marine archaeology is about. It's changing now. It's changing slowly. We know about Doggerland. As a result, and archaeologists are beginning to look at it. But my point is that the vast area that was submerged during the end of the Ice Age has never been studied by archaeology at all. And they're not in a position to say that they know that there's no possibility of a lost civilization during the Ice Age, while they haven't investigated those 27 million square kilometers that are now underwater, when they haven't investigated the Sahara Desert. Well, Santa and I decided to do some investigation of our own underwater. And actually, we spent the best part of 10 years scuba diving all over the world, following up tales and traditions from local divers and fishermen looking for structures underwater. And here at Ponape, the well-known site of Nan Madol, we followed up the advice of local divers, and we went underwater. And we find that the site doesn't just stop there. It continues underwater. And at first, it continues with the same kind of construction that you see above water. But as you go deeper, as you get down to about 27 meters underwater, you start seeing structures that are completely different, these huge pillars underwater. A fallen pillar here, which is very interesting because it so closely resembles the pillars of Tinian in nearby area of the Pacific. Micronesia, and this is Tinian, and I'm suggesting again that that pillar underwater suggests to us that Tinian megalith may be much older than we're told. That's my fins disappearing through a tunnel underwater in Japan. Santa and I did more than 200 dives around this site. It's called Yonaguni. And I'm going to show you why I believe archaeologists are wrong. Archaeologists who've never dived there, who wouldn't even contemplate diving there. Diving at Yonaguni is really dangerous. There's a massive current there. You get swept away. If you try and stop and examine the structure, you end up fighting the sea. And believe me, you don't want to fight the sea. When the sea sends a current your way, the best thing you can do is just go with it adrift, and that's great fun. But you try to hang on to a structure, and the sea's going to beat you up badly. Well, that's the edges of that tunnel. And as you can see, it's a megalithic tunnel with one block piled on top of the other. And then at the end of the tunnel, we see this. Two blocks positioned side by side. And that's me just diving down beside those blocks to show their nature and their scale. They're enormous. And archaeologists say, oh, no problem. They must have fallen from some cliff overhead. The only problem is there is no cliff overhead, and never has been. So those two blocks, this is them in context. There they are. That tunnel that I went through is down here. There's the two blocks, and then there's this massive, completely natural stone outcropping. I'm not disputing that it's natural, but as we continue to explore that outcropping, what do we find? We find a flat terrace, and we find steps on the terrace. And in my mind, this speaks strongly of human workmanship. Japan is a megalithic culture. Many of the megaliths in Japan have never really been properly studied. This one is called Masado no Iwafuna, the upside-down boat stone the Asuka area of Japan. It's interesting that if you go around to the other side of that huge megalith, you'll see how it was created. They cut out these grooves in it, creating these outcroppings, which if they'd finished the work, would have been smoothed off and left to look like the rest of the structure. Oddly enough, exactly the same stone cutting technique is found underwater at Yonaguni. And since it's nearly 30 meters underwater, it's been underwater for more than 12,000 years. Above water in Japan, you do have megalithic stone circles. The one at the top left is from Hokkaido. Aomori on the right, very small river stones used to create a circle. And then Shikoku down at the bottom left. Well, we heard of a site in the Kerama Islands, in the southern part of Japan, where there was a stone circle underwater. Well, we couldn't resist that. So we went diving there. And lo and behold, what did we find? A massive stone circle. And indeed, circles made of small river stones as well, but 30 meters underwater, 12,000 years old plus. What is going on here? Well, that's me with a video camera up there and a diver down there beside the central upright for scale. These megaliths, like the pillars at Karahantepe, are carved out of bedrock. They're carved out of bedrock. And it's really difficult for me to see how nature could have done this. There I am on top of the central upright. Look at the way the outer curve of the central upright matches the inner curve of one of the outer uprights. Here we are now in Taiwan. From that island of Yonaguni, Taiwan is actually visible on a clear day. Here we're underwater with local diver Steve Shear at Taiwan, and he's showing us a wall he discovered underwater, about 20 meters underwater. And that wall has battlements, and it has a kind of plaza in front of it. And unless there's any doubt that it's man-made, let's get up close and look at it. It's made of individual blocks of stone. This doesn't happen naturally. This is a man-made structure underwater, which archaeology has paid absolutely zero attention to. And then what about India? Diving in Indian waters is often quite murky. There's a lot of sediment in the water. It makes it very difficult to see. But here's South India as it looked during the Ice Age, when sea level was much lower. Sri Lanka was joined to South India. And I'm interested in two sites in particular in South India, Pumpahar and Mahabalipuram. Pumpahar we heard about from the National Oceanographic Institute of India, who are based in Goa. And they kindly actually took us diving at Pumpahar and showed us what they are confident is a man-made structure. They describe it as a U-shaped structure at 29 meters underwater. And I apologize for the visibility, but that's what you dive in there. Fishermen get their nets caught on it. It causes trouble to fishermen all the time. In fact, they would like it removed. And there are individual blocks surrounding it. Further north at Mahabalipuram, Vasantha and I, who investigated this area first. Santha speaks the Tamil language as her first language. And so we were able to communicate easily and fluently with local fishermen. And we asked them at Mahabalipuram, is there anything underwater that you guys know about? And they said, yeah, there's a whole city out there. And we're really annoyed about it because we keep catching our nets on it and we have to send down divers, and they're not scuba divers, free divers. And sometimes they get killed. And we've asked the government to do something about it, but they don't believe us. Well, we believe them. It took about 2 years to organize the expedition. And we had to involve the Scientific Exploration Society led by John Blashford Snell in Britain. As you can see, it was a very high-tech expedition. And off we went, diving off the waters of Mahabalipuram. And immediately, we saw the fishermen were right, that there are man-made structures underwater, two blocks side by side here, a bit of a wall sticking above the sand, a wall with a standout feature. There I'm putting my dive knife into the gap between two blocks. Another pair of blocks there, and a curved feature. There's so much more underwater at Mahabalipuram. Well, following that investigation, it was decided that some archaeology would be done. But to my frustration, the archaeology so far has been confined to the intertidal zone, just down to 5 meters, and they haven't been down to 27 to 30 meters where we found these structures yet. So, you know, if Santa and I, out of our own pocket, can go diving and find stuff underwater which doesn't fit the picture of history that we're given by archaeologists, what would be found if real investment were put into searching the underwater, the submerged continental shelves? I think a great deal would be found. There's another area of the world where archaeologists haven't looked enough. And that area of the world is the Amazon rainforest. It's about 7 million square kilometers in size. And there have been tragic clearances of the Amazon, as we all know. Terrible mistake to cut down old growth rainforests and replace it with soybean farms to feed cattle so that we can all eat hamburgers. What a stupid decision, especially since rainforest soils are not particularly fertile and they are fertilized by the fall of vegetation onto them. Once you remove the trees, you're in a place that soybean farm is only going to last 10 years, then it's going to be useless. So the destruction of the Amazon is a huge mistake that human beings are making. We've still got 5.5 million square kilometers left covered by rainforest. And extraordinary evidence is beginning to come out of those 5.5 million kilometers. Not just that genetic signal that connects peoples of the Amazon to peoples of Australasia, but real archaeology. This is in one of the areas already cleared. And this is the work of Marty Parson and Sana Saunaloma and Alkeo Ranzi, who have been investigating what they describe as the Amazonian geoglyphs. And here we have a square with an embankment around it. And here we have a square with its own embankment surrounding a circle with its own embankment. It actually looks a bit like the henges that we find in England. It's very like Avebury Henge, as a matter of fact, in many ways. And this is where it's happening. It's in the Brazilian state of Acre. And it's the location of the principal geoglyph sites that have been discovered by 2019. There's another one. They're very geometrical, these geoglyphs. The circle enclosing a square or an oval enclosing a square are repeated again and again. And here we have these sort of curious little scallops taken out of a square and another circle. And Tekino is a massive site, 37 acres it once extended over. But its two principal squares still remain. The largest measures 210 by 210 meters. It's got two further squares internested within it. And the smaller square, which has been extensively damaged, measures 130 by 130 meters. The larger square is 40 meters wide and opens onto a causeway 1.5 kilometers long. And all this was happening in the Amazon thousands of years ago. So, keep in mind this redrawing of this site, Fazenda Colorada. Just keep it in mind for a moment. I'll come to why it matters. Fazenda Piranha and Severino Calazans are both oriented to true astronomical north, as are the Giza pyramids. And Severino Calazans on the right has the same footprint as the Great Pyramid of Giza, measuring 230 meters along each side, and is equally precisely aligned to true astronomical north. Now I'm going to talk a bit about ayahuasca, which is one of the great discoveries of the peoples of the Amazon. This is Shipibo ayahuasca art. And as you can see, part of the art of ayahuasca is geometry. It's filled with geometry. Anybody who's had an experience in a deeply altered state of consciousness, whether with psilocybin, whether with LSD, whether with DMT, which is the active ingredient in ayahuasca, will almost certainly at some point or another see geometrical patterns. They're very common in the early stages of the journey. And what is depicted here is visions seen under the influence of ayahuasca. And on the right here, we have an amazing painting by the late, great Pablo Amaringo, a great visionary artist, worked with ayahuasca all his life and was gifted as an artist. And he shows us something of the enchanted realm that ayahuasca can bring us into. And it's seen as literally as a portal. Ayahuasca is seen as a portal that takes us to the other side. I want to be clear that ayahuasca is very serious business. I've had 75 or so sessions with ayahuasca. I'm not in a rush to have my next. I want to dispel the myth at the moment that any hallucinogens are addictive. They are not. There are no addictive hallucinogens. Unfortunately, medical science is beginning to catch up with the fantastic potential, therapeutic potential of these ancient medicines. But ayahuasca is very serious business. It's going to make you confront truths about yourself that you might prefer not to know. You're going to go through a bit of a physical ordeal. You're going to vomit. You're going to have diarrhea. I mean, nobody's rushing to do that, you know. And actually, just looking at the brew there just does make me feel a little bit sick. So you have to brace yourself for an ayahuasca experience. And another of Pablo's visions. We'll notice that there are creatures called therianthropes in this vision. Those are the body of an animal and the head of a human being, or it can be the other way around. It's from the Greek therion, which means wild beast, and anthropos, which means human. Again, these are very commonly reported, and I've seen them myself many times, in visions in altered states of consciousness. Entities are encountered, and often they take animal form or mixed animal and human form. And here, the Tucano of the Amazon their culture is particularly closely connected to ayahuasca. And here we see a Tucano shaman guiding his son through an ayahuasca experience, helping him navigate the infinite terrain of the other side. And in the other photographs, we see Tucano ayahuasca art, which again is reflecting the geometry seen in ayahuasca visions. I'm going to read this. This is from Gerardo Rigel Dolmatov, one of the great experts on Tucano. Although any member of the Tucano community may drink ayahuasca, the deeper mysteries of the brew are primarily the work of the shaman, whose responsibility it is to travel through the portal to the other side, whenever required, to negotiate with powerful supernaturals on behalf of his community. Where matters of the greatest importance must be resolved, a group of payes will work together, consuming massive quantities of ayahuasca, until they reach a point lying in their hammocks where they feel they are ascending to the Milky Way. The ascent to the Milky Way is not easily accomplished. An apprentice will hardly ever be able to rise immediately to this sublunary region, but rather will learn to do so after many trials. At first, he will barely rise over the horizon. The next time, perhaps he will reach a point corresponding to the position of the sun at 9 a.m., then at 10 a.m., and so on until at last, in a single soaring flight, he will reach the zenith. So, in summary, the shaman's visionary journey through the ayahuasca portal involves a leap, or after sufficient practice, a soaring flight to the Milky Way. Not the final goal. It's a way station. Beyond the Milky Way lies the entrance to the other world. And again, I'll quote Gerardo Rachel Dolmatov. It is said that the individual dies when he drinks the potion, and that now his spirit returns to the uterine regions of the beyond, only to be reborn there and to return to his ordinary existence when the trance is over. This then is conceived as an acceleration of time, an anticipation of death and rebirth. So ayahuasca is a kind of guide to the afterlife realm. It's a kind of book of the dead, not written in text, but in direct experience. And on the lower left there, this is the entrance to the other world, as depicted in Tucano ayahuasca art. So I'll bring you back to that diagram, that site at Fazenda, Colorado, that I drew your attention to. And I can't help noticing how similar this part of it is to the entrance to the other world, as depicted in Tucano art. There's much other research that supports this, that the Amazonian geoglyphs were connected to the same complex of death and afterlife beliefs that flourished in ancient Egypt, and I'll come to this, and in the ancient Mississippi Valley in North America. So, top left, this is a great Western ayahuasca artist, my friend Martina Hoffman. She's depicting some of the many manifestations of Mother Ayahuasca. This is generally how we in the West experience the entity behind the ayahuasca brew, who has harnessed the ayahuasca brew to access human consciousness. In some cultures, the spirit of ayahuasca is seen as male, not as female. That's particularly so amongst a few of the Amazonian cultures, but generally, the spirit is seen as female. She's a shapeshifter. She can be whatever she wants to be. I'm just struck by the similarity to this Egyptian image from the right, the goddess Isis, feeding Ankh, immortal life, to the pharaoh Seti I. And let's not forget, for more than 3,000 years, the ancient Egyptians put their best minds to work on the mystery of death. And we should not dismiss their explorations into what happens after death as simple fantasies, because there's 3,000 years of work went into those explanations. Of course, scientists don't believe in any survival of death. For science, which is focused largely on weighing, measuring, and counting, we're just biological machines. We got our consciousness accident. It's an accidental byproduct. It's an epiphenomenon of brain activity. We needed these big brains to compete in the jungle of the universe. And as an accident, our big brains gave us consciousness. The notion, therefore, that consciousness might survive death is abhorrent to most scientists, particularly to scientists like Richard Dawkins, who somehow knows that there is no life after death. How can anybody possibly know that? It's a great mystery. None of us know what's going to happen when we die. Maybe we just will blink out and there's nothing more. Or maybe there is something more, as many ancient traditions suggest. I think we should listen to those ancient traditions. Ayahuasca means the vine of souls or the vine of the dead, and does so for good reasons. There are many similarities in the ayahuasca journey to what we call near-death experiences in the West. A sense of encounter with those who have passed on, with deceased relatives communicating with us. And very frequently, and painfully, ayahuasca requires us to confront and question our own behavior during life. It puts us on the spot. She puts us on the spot. Look at your own life and look at it seriously. What have you done with it? And this is so similar to the ancient Egyptian view, which is expressed symbolically as the judgment of the soul. Here, in one of the tombs of the nobles on the West Bank at Luxor in Upper Egypt, we see the deceased being ushered into what is called the Hall of Maat. This is the goddess Maat, and that feather that is her symbol that she wears on her headdress is the feather of truth and cosmic justice and harmony. The soul is brought into her presence and then confronts this scene, which is the weighing of the soul. The soul depicted here as the heart of the individual, weighed in the scales against the feather of Maat. You do not want your heart to be heavy with wickedness and to outweigh that feather. You want to be in balance with that feather from the ancient Egyptian point of view. Now, there are many moral aspects to the ancient Egyptian judgment scene. These guys up here are called the 42 negative assessors. And they're going to ask the soul 42 questions. And ideally, the soul should be able to answer no to every one of them. They include some of the Ten Commandments. Did you kill? Did you steal? Did you lie? Ideally, we should be able to answer no to all of them. But the ancient Egyptians knew that we are frail human beings. We will constantly make mistakes. We will constantly backslide during life. The point is, do we use this opportunity of life to make ourselves better people? Or do we waste that opportunity of life? So there's the scales, and there's the feather, and there's the heart. And over here on the right is the god Thoth, the god of wisdom, supposed inventor of writing, who's writing down the judgment on a pallet. Over here is Amit, the eater of the dead, those who have lived wicked, selfish, cruel, vicious lives. Their journey will not continue. They will face annihilation in the Hall of Maat. And sitting at the head of the hall is the god Osiris. I love this image that Santa photographed in the tombs of the nobles. The objective of the whole journey is that at the end of it, you should be able to look your own soul in the face and say, yes, I made mistakes. Yes, I committed errors. But I tried to put them right. And by and large, I did good. And there's another more fundamental question than any of the moral questions. And that question, it seems to me, is, did you get it? Did you get what we gave you the gift of life for, what the universe gave you the gift of life for? It's a precious opportunity to be born in a human body, to have the potential to explore consciousness in the way that we do. Did you get it that you were given a privilege to be here? Or did you waste your time on frivolous pursuits and on production and consumption and on your ego and on accumulating material possessions? The ancient Egyptian pyramid texts are the oldest recension of what we know of as the Book of the Dead. These are carved on the walls of the 5th dynasty pyramid of Unas. That is the name of Unas there. That's his cartouche. And over there, this circle surrounding a star depicts the Duat. That was the name for the ancient Egyptian afterlife realm through which our soul would journey after death and be tested on the life that we've lived. And these are other recensions of the same ideas, the ancient Egyptian coffin texts, the Book of the Dead, the Book of What is in the Duat. They seek to prepare us for our journey through the afterlife. I love this double exposure that Santa took. In the foreground is the Pyramid of Unas with the pyramid texts. And then on the second exposure behind, we have the Great Pyramid and its neighboring pyramids. And I would suggest that what the pyramid texts and the books of the dead achieve in hieroglyphs and imagery, the pyramids of Giza and Acropolis manifest in 3 dimensions, because the Giza pyramids are not inscribed. So scholars agree that Osiris was identified by the ancient Egyptians with the constellation of Orion. The ancient Egyptians called that constellation Sahu. And he was viewed as the figure of Osiris in the night sky, ruling over the afterlife kingdom of the Duat. And the Duat itself was not underground. It was envisaged as being located in the sky between the constellations of Leo and Orion, with the great heavenly river of the Milky Way, the winding waterway, as its central feature. As you can see, the constellation of Orion stands beside the Milky Way. I want to pay tribute to the work of my great friend, Robert Bovall, the originator of the Orion correlation theory, which, of course, archaeology has completely rejected, largely because archaeologists just don't understand astronomy and don't want to. This is not the sky above Egypt in 4,500 years ago. That's the other problem, because the sky is constantly changed because of a wobble on the Earth's axis called precession. The Earth is our viewing platform from which we observe the stars, so naturally the wobble changes our perspective on the stars. This is the sky of roughly between 12,800 and 11,600 years ago. And as the constellation of Orion crosses the meridian, we see that it's in the same pattern as the three great pyramids on the ground, and there, rising due east in that period, is the constellation of Leo, gazed at directly by the Great Sphinx, the Leonine Great Sphinx. So in the ancient Egyptian view, how does the soul of the earthly deceased ascend to the Duat? Well, it does so through a leap or a flight, just as the Tucano described. There are narrow shafts cut through the walls of the Great Pyramid, two of them in the King's Chamber, the so-called King's Chamber, and two of them in the Queen's Chamber. The Queen's Chamber shafts actually don't exit on the outside of the pyramid. The King's Chamber shafts do. And one of those shafts from the King's Chamber points directly at the lowest of the three stars of Orion's belt. And here's the mystery, because although the layout on the ground depicts the skies 12,000 years ago or so, this connection to the stars is indeed from the era of 4,500 years ago. I am not seeking to divorce the ancient Egyptians from the construction of the Great Pyramids. I think they were intimately involved. I think they were completing a much older project. I see platforms on the ground there going back 12,000 years and the work completed by the ancient Egyptians, who tell us how the knowledge was passed down to them from what they call Zeptepi, the first time. So there's this leap to the heavens that involves the journey through the Duat in ancient Egypt. I'll just quote a few passages from a book that Santha and I published in 1998, Heaven's Mirror, concerning Mexico. Excuse me for reading, but my memory these days is not quite what it was 40 years ago. Very much like the ancient Egyptians, the peoples of ancient Central America located their netherworld in a region of the sky through which ran the Milky Way. For the Maya, the Milky Way was a particularly important feature of the heavens. They conceived of it as the road that led to their netherworld, Xibalba, which in common with other Central American peoples and with the ancient Egyptians and with the Tucano, they located in the sky. So here we have a study of Utatlan's major temples, studied by Fernandez Cormac et al., Mayan city of Utatlan, Guatemala, designed according to the celestial scheme reflected by the shape of the constellation of Orion. He's able to prove that all of Utatlan's major temples were oriented to the helical setting points of the stars in Orion, and he argued that the Milky Way, alongside which Orion stands, was thought of as a celestial path connecting the firmament's navel with the center of the underworld. So close to the ancient Egyptian idea. I'm not saying the ancient Egyptians brought it to Central America or the other way around. I'm just observing the connection, the similarity in this complex set of religious beliefs. Orion was extensively involved in Mayan rebirth beliefs, which described the constellation and specifically its three belt stars as the turtle of rebirth. In Egypt, as amongst the Maya, the stellar context involves Orion and the Milky Way. In Egypt, as in Mexico, a journey through the netherworld must be undertaken by the deceased. In Egypt, as in Mexico, religious teachings assert that life is our opportunity to prepare for this journey, an opportunity that should, under no circumstances, be missed. Let's go to North America now. This is the tragedy of the American, North American pyramids, often referred to as mounds. The tragedy. There was once more than a million of them. Only 100,000 are left now. And most of those 100,000 have been subjected to horrific destruction. I'm looking at Mound A from Mound B here. As you can see, Mound A has been largely destroyed. A little bit of it is left. Well, here's a notice board at Moundville in Alabama, and I'm going to show you what the text of that notice board says, because this is official archaeology that's saying this. And I have no problem with what official archaeology is saying here. Because what they're saying is, at Moundville, an excellent example of a powerful religious image was the hand and eye motif. Moundville's rattlesnake disc, pictured on that notice board, offers us the best known version, although numerous variations occur, etc., etc. Stories passed down among various tribes tell of the dead entering the afterlife through an opening marked by a great warrior's hand in the sky. One account describes that hand as the constellation we know as Orion, with Orion's belt as its wrist, its fingers pointing downwards. A faint cluster of stars in the center of the palm is a portal to the path of souls, or the path to the land of the dead. Researchers speculate that the hand and eye represent this constellation. Pick up a few more comments that we found on the official notice boards at Moundville, again highlighting Orion. As a group, the knotted serpents on the hand and eye are believed to be a representation of the night sky. The serpents are the ropes that join the earth and sky. In the palm of the hand is a portal or doorway through which the spirits of the dead can ascend the path of souls, or Milky Way, in their extended journey to the realm of the dead. Path of souls, again mentioned there. The gateway or portal between the celestial realms and the earth disk was symbolized and artistically rendered as an open hand with an eye in its palm. We know the hand as part of the constellation of Orion. Once the portal was crossed, the souls of the dead began their journey by walking along a road or ribbon of light, the Milky Way. Essentially the same spiritual idea that's expressed in ancient Egypt and in South America. And this is how it works. The Orion's belt was the wrist, and other stars of Orion were involved in the fingers and the thumb. It's an example of the hand and eye motif, and the Orion nebula is represented by the eye in the palm of the hand, and was conceived of as a portal through which the soul must leap on its afterlife journey. Now, Professor George Langford is an internationally recognized authority on Native American folklore, anthropology, religious studies, and ethnohistory. And he notes that the portal in the hand must be entered by a leap at the optimum time. Again, we're looking at a system of religious ideas that seems to have been shared all around the world concerning the afterlife destiny of the soul. And I'm not suggesting that Egypt influenced Mexico or influenced North America. I'm suggesting the possibility of a remote common source from which these ideas descended and were disseminated all around the world. So we have another leap up to a portal in the sky in the constellation of Orion. And there's the ancient Egyptian hieroglyph for the Duat, as I showed you, from the Pyramid of Unas, a star enclosed within a circle. And in ancient Native America, George Langford writes, the hole in the sky is indicated as a slit being pulled apart, and the fact that it is celestial is frequently elaborated by the inclusion of a star circle or dot. On the Native American afterlife journey, there's encounters with all kind of monsters who will test us on the lives that we have lived. And one of them is called the Brain Smasher, usually a woman, whose task is to destroy memory by removing or smashing the brain. Indeed, there are repeated references to a menacing female figure, usually called the Brain Smasher or the Brain Taker, in accounts of the Native American afterlife journey. Her role is the annihilation, just like that eater of the dead in the ancient Egyptian scene. Her role is the annihilation and permanent destruction of unworthy souls, of the damned, on the afterlife journey. So here's this vignette from the ancient Egyptian Book of the Dead. The original translation given by E.A. Wallace Budge was very flimsy in my view. When I look at this scene, I don't see an individual smashing himself in the head just voluntarily. I see that goddess projecting power to him and making him inflict that destruction on himself. So I wanted to get a full translation of this scene. What is that? Who is that woman? What is happening here? And so I went to Louise Ellis Barrett at the British Museum, and she provided me with the translation and what that female figure is doing. She lives from the blood of the damned and from what these gods provide her, the demolishing one who cuts the damned to pieces. She is, in other words, a brain smasher. The star Deneb in the constellation we know as Cygnus the Swan is positioned on the bank of the Milky Way exactly at the fork where a second path, a dead end, branches off. George Langford identifies Deneb and Cygnus as a whole with the Moundville raptor figure. A bird, an adversary on the journey of the soul, with the power to block its further progress by forcing it to take a path culminating in a dead end. In the ancient Egyptian pyramid text, the soul on its journey through the Duat is confronted by a bird adversary that apparently has the power to block its path. It's difficult to give any other interpretation to this encounter, since the soul is made to declare, "Hail to you, ostrich." That's a bird of Egypt. "Hail to you, ostrich, which is on the bank of the winding waterway. Open my way that I may pass." And likewise, what else but recognition of the same fork in the Milky Way that was regarded as so ominous in Native America can be expressed in the pyramid text where we read, "Do not travel on those western waterways, for those who travel thereon do not return, but travel on the eastern waterways." Here are monstrous winged serpents from the ancient Egyptian netherworld. Here are monstrous winged serpents from the ancient American netherworld. Here is another of those monsters encountered on the journey of the soul in ancient North America, upper right, the underwater panther. And I'm just drawing attention to the similarities of the underwater panther to the Great Sphinx of Giza. On the right, we see the chief of the astronomers, a religious figure amongst the Skidi Pawnee of ancient North America. He was known as the chief of the astronomers, and he wears a robe spangled with stars. Interestingly, there was also a figure called the chief of the astronomers in ancient Egypt, and he also wore a robe spangled with stars, or sometimes with a leopard skin where the dots represented the stars. Coincidence, or something going on behind the scenes that we haven't figured out? On the left, from North America, an engraved whelk shell, and it is depicting the hero deity referred to by archaeologists as the Birdman and symbolized as a hawk. On the right, a statue of Horus, an Egyptian hero deity, likewise symbolized as a hawk. The fundamental role of both these hawk-headed deities was to represent the triumph of life over death. So both the ancient Egyptian and the ancient Native American afterlife journeys involve a strong element of judgment. Indeed, in a sense, the entire ordeal in both cases concerns the judgment of the soul for its choices, for what it has done and has not done, for the use it has made of the gift of life during its physical incarnation. In both cases, the unworthy soul can face annihilation by gods, demons, and monsters at any point on the journey, for example, at the hands of the brain smasher figure, but in both cases also for those who have progressed thus far through the netherworld, a specific judgment awaits. And in both cases, the desired outcome was to leap up to immortal life amongst the stars. And I love this figure here of the initiate ascending on a serpent into the stars. And indeed, it inspired the title of John West's wonderful book, Serpent in the Sky. So I don't think we're looking at coincidence here. There's too much going on. I think coincidence is a very weak explanation for what's happening. One possibility is mentioned as a remote shared ancestor. Another is convergent experiences in altered states of consciousness. Actually, my vote goes to both. I think that we are dealing with an ancestor who passed down a legacy of knowledge and an ancestor that was deeply involved in visionary experiences. And those visionary experiences have continued to the present day. So just a few more slides now. Sorry that I have to read. My memory is not what it was. The origin myth of the Tucano speaks of the time eons ago, when humans first settled the great rivers of the Amazon basin. It seems that supernatural beings accompanied them on this journey and gifted them the fundamentals on which to build a civilized life. From the daughter of the sun, they received the gift of fire and the knowledge of horticulture, pottery making, and many other crafts. The serpent-shaped canoe of the first settlers was steered by a superhuman helmsman. Meanwhile, other supernaturals traveled by canoe all over the rivers, explored the remote hill ranges. They pointed out propitious sites for houses or fields or for hunting and fishing, and they left their lasting imprint on many spots so that future generations would have ineffaceable proof of their earthly days and would forever remember them and their teachings. Over in Easter Island, Ancient legends speak of a primeval Pacific homeland called Hiva, from which the very first inhabitants of Easter Island supposedly came, a homeland that was submerged under the sea. And it's particularly intriguing that this tradition speaks of seven sages who are said to have been instrumental in the original settlement of Easter Island. Seven sages. And the first task of the seven sages from Hiva after their arrival on Easter Island was the construction of stone mounds. Mesopotamia, Oannes, and again, seven sages of ancient Mesopotamia. The seven sages were remembered as teaching advanced astronomical and geodetic knowledge, including all the skills necessary for planning and setting out a city. And they appeared amongst humanity after an enormous world-destroying flood. Same story roughly occurs in India. Manu and the seven sages, rescued from the universal deluge by the fish avatar of Vishnu. This theme of seven sages keeps on coming up again and again, and it comes up at this amazing temple, the temple of Horus at Edfu in Upper Egypt, a temple that was relatively late in the Egyptian story. It was built around 300, even the late 280s BC, but it was built on a much more ancient site. And the language inscribed on its walls is not the Egyptian that was spoken at that time. It's Middle Egyptian. It's a language that goes back to 2000 BC. The Edfu building texts, as they're called, are found between the inner and outer enclosure walls of the temple. And this is what they look like. I had drawn attention to this curious T-shaped pattern earlier. And they speak of a homeland of the primeval ones, an island like Atlantis. Ooh, archaeologists hate the word Atlantis. Say the word Atlantis and you're automatically a lunatic, you know, because they've proved that Atlantis could never have existed, even though they have not looked at the parts of the world that need to be looked at, even though their study of the world is very, very, very incomplete. An island like Atlantis that was destroyed in an immense and cataclysmic flood. A snake called the Great Leaping One is described as the chief enemy of the god. It's his assault that causes the homeland of the primeval ones to be swallowed up by the sea. But first the island was pierced and the domain was split. And the texts also speak of survivors of the destruction of the primeval island of the gods, specifically named as seven sages, of their wanderings afterwards and of their project to reconstitute or resurrect their lost former world. They came to Egypt and established religion by building primeval mounds up and down the Nile Valley. And there's Plato's story of Atlantis and how the gods purged the earth with a deluge of water and how the survivors are left, have to begin all over again like children with no memory of what went before. And I'm suggesting that that's what we are. We're the children who have no memory of what went before those cataclysmic floods at the end of the Ice Age. And it's interesting that the story comes to Plato through his family line, through his ancestor Solon. And Solon did make a famous visit to Egypt around the year 600 BC. He was a well-known Greek lawmaker. And he visited the temple of Neith at Sais in the Delta. That temple no longer exists. And there he encountered priests and asked them to explain to him the writings on the walls. And the priests told him of a great civilization that had been destroyed in an enormous flood and that had left some survivors who had come to Egypt. And Solon asked the priests, when did this flood happen? When was Atlantis buried? And by the way, in the dialogues, Plato makes it clear that he's Grecianizing ancient Egyptian words. Atlantis is not an ancient Egyptian word. So Solon asked the priests, when was this flood? When was Atlantis submerged? And they said, quite matter-of-factly, oh, 9,000 years ago. That was in 600 BC. It's so easy to do the math. That means 9,600 BC in our calendar. They're telling us that this lost civilization was submerged in a great flood around 11,600 years before our time. This is why I think we need to pay attention to the Atlantis story rather than just write it off as the ravings of the lunatic fringe. And my God, Plato was no lunatic fringe. It just so happens that 11,600 years ago coincides not only with the construction of Göbekli Tepe, but also with Meltwater Pulse 1b, a very rapid global sea level rise over a period of several hundred years. Now, archaeologists say, oh, Meltwater Pulse 1b wasn't a big deal. If you do the average over 300 years, it's only a few meters a year. Averages don't work with sea level rise. It came in pulses. And when you look at the detail, you find that there were periods when there was enormous sea level rise in a short period of time. And you can tell this from submerged corals in the Bahamas, for example. So the myths speak repeatedly of the coming of the sages in context of a great cataclysm, a derangement of the heavens, cosmic serpents, a global flood, a time of cold and darkness. And frankly, the Younger Dryas from 12,800 to 11,600 years ago is the only epoch in the lifetime of anatomically modern humans that fits the bill. What happened on Earth begins in the sky, as above, so below. And that's why we called the series Ancient Apocalypse. And that's the end of this talk. I'm going to take a 15-minute break now. I imagine some of you need a break too. And then I'll be back with a second shorter talk. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.